Slut shame, shaming Voldemort, credentials versus competence, and the Tsar's numbered days. This is Last Impressions number 5. I'm Justin Katz. So this week I've been noticing something kind of funny in local newspapers, actually all of the local ones. You know, we have the Seconnet Times, Newport Daily News, and the Fall River Herald all kind of cover Tiverton out here. And I've been noticing that letters to the editor, criticisms of me, I've noticed they're not using my name. They're saying a budget committee member, because I'm on a budget committee, if you didn't know that, in Tiverton. It's an elected position. We're kind of the last stage of government that helps set the budget before the voters get to vote at the financial town referendum. But in the local papers, it's becoming actually something of a joke to, or something humorous to me, is that I've become he who must not be named in Tiverton. I mean, as if apparently it's become something of a thing in a left-wing echo chamber across the country not to use the villains, the bad guys' names, because you don't want to empower conservatives, from Donald Trump all the way down to some nobody on a budget committee in a smallish town in Tiverton, Rhode Island. And in some ways, it's kind of like Soviet Russia. I mean, we're the disappeared. We've said things that are unsayable. We have views that are unthinkable, and therefore we should not be named. We shouldn't get credit, because if we're named, we just get name recognition and all that stuff. But you know, I've always focused on this activity, commentary, local government, as a honestly way to come to an agreement, you know, to argue things out and persuade people. It's not political first for me, so it's kind of weird. I mean, well, first, as a political measure, how can people punish elected officials who are doing bad things or being bad people if the person who wants to punish them has to tap into the kind of the whisper mill to get the name? So, I had to call you up and find out who you're talking about so I can vote against them next time. It doesn't make much sense to me. And second of all, if it's not a deliberate thing, if this isn't a, you know, the left wing conspiracy to disempower or disappear conservatives, well, how credible are people's views on these things, like a budget? So if you're in the audience, and most of them say, I've never gone to these meetings before and this is my first time, if you don't even care to know who the people are that are interacting and asking these offensive questions or grilling the local officials on why they possibly could need so much more money, that's just unthinkable for elected officials to grill the hired employees about their budgets. But I mean, if you don't even care to find out the names of those people and refer to them, how is your factual analysis going to be? My suspicion in general on this thing, nationally and state level, locally, is that it indicates that the people doing these things, the letter writers or the op-ed writers or the talking heads on certain news stations, they're talking among themselves mainly. I mean, they're not trying to persuade anybody. They're just trying to rally each other around and assert their goodness. So yes, I'm proud to finally have put my finger on it. I'm Voldemort of Tiverton. And I'm working on becoming Voldemort of Rhode Island. Unfortunately, at the national level, there are way too many contenders, and I'm not even going to set my sights that high. But the irony here is that, at least in Tiverton, I'm the good guy, which brings me to thinking that we live in strange times, and it's going to require us to stand, to take a stand, to stand up for ourselves and each other. As a tease for last week's podcast, I jokingly used the word slut to describe Scarlett Johansson. Now, bear in mind, she's a multimillionaire actress who has no clue that I exist and probably wouldn't care if she somehow caught wind of my existence. The power difference culturally is just tremendous here. And so it makes you wonder, can one, quote, slut shame up the social ladder like that? I don't think so. And I had a lot of classes where they tried to teach me sort of progressive thinking and left-wing kind of approaches to things. And that's how I remember how I learned that this whole shame thing works, that the powerless can't be invidious shamers. And I think I'm coining that term. Invidious was a word that came up a lot in, say, the same-sex marriage debate, where you have to differentiate between discrimination in a neutral sense. I'm discriminating between these two types of, salad dressings. I have a discriminating palate, that kind of thing, versus the bad discrimination that really hurts people and for no reason. That's invidious discrimination. So I'm coining the term invidious shamers. The powerless can't be. You can try to shame up the social ladder. You can say things like shame on you, but it doesn't have the teeth. And, that's why feminists will insist that even innocent statements from bosses are objectionable. Like, oh, you look nice today. Well, you're the boss. That has a different meaning. You're up the social ladder. And it's also why racialists, as opposed to racists, people who make a big deal out of race and everything, insist that minorities can never be racist because they are the powerless group. They can't be racist. So it just doesn't seem to me, unless by definition, even relatively powerless men somehow have some, whether feminists are conceding that we have some kind of universal power to bring down bolts of lightning from the sky. It just doesn't seem like we should be considered able to be sexist up the ladder like that. It just doesn't work. And I certainly don't imagine that I've got that much power, but frankly, all of it seems like a convenient put on to me. I mean, if you look at, not to get too much into local stuff, but if you look at who's attacking me now in Tiverton, these are, and I think this applies nationally to people attacking Donald Trump and people attacking Jeff Sessions or anybody else. These are people who've called me much, much worse. They're people who've said, actually, I would argue, more sexist, things that are more sexist about women friends of mine, one of whom they've made cry. I mean, it's like fundamentally, not just a word, but fundamentally sexist things about friends of mine. These are people who've published details about my children online and then used local soccer mail lists to send vicious propaganda about me, including to other parents, including my wife. I mean, as a recipient, I'm going to be slut-shamed by these people? No, sir, or, ma'am, if that's what you prefer. Another thing this week, to revisit a recent podcast when I mentioned Tom Nichols, who's a professor at Newark, who's got a book out saying people need to listen to experts more. And I had pointed him out on Bill Rapley's Channel 10 show talking about his book. And I noted that when he said, we have to listen, we have experts for a reason. We can't all just go out and decide to just drive on the wrong side of the road tomorrow. And I point out, we kind of can. That's the point of democracy. We can collectively decide what to do with the experts. What to do with the experts' advice. We can disregard it or not. And he makes exactly that point, made exactly that point in the last week on Dan York's talk radio show on WPRO 630. Here he is.
Where we can have legitimate arguments is over what to do about it. If someone says, look, we're pretty sure that, Providence is going to sink into the sea in 40 years. It's not wrong. I mean, this is where I take issue with the experts. And in the book, I do talk about when experts get things wrong or where they overstep their bounds. If the people of Providence want to say, listen, I don't care about what happens 40 years from now. And if the city sinks into the ocean, so be it. That's our choice. It's not for an expert to say, no, you can't make that choice. I mean, I really defend the principle in the book that the people have the right to be wrong.
Well, let me be the first to say that I'm very, very happy we have the right to be wrong. I offer that almost as a concession to the people who dislike me or other conservatives. we have a right to be wrong, and it does happen. But it's good to hear Professor Nichols chiming in on that side of the argument. And, you know, I think he and I would agree on a whole bunch of things, probably even more if you know, he weren't an actual expert and I just play one on the internet. But his book did come up also in a number of places I've seen, just in my regular reading nationally and locally. He was on, for example, they brought him up on ricochet.com. You can go for a bunch of relatively highbrow conservative podcasts and other and blog posts. And the three of the editors of Commentary Magazine have one. They do regularly, weekly, maybe two a week or something like that. And they were actually brought up Professor Nichols' book talking about how it seems as if the elite nowadays aren't getting anything right. They're not getting election predictions right. Hillary Clinton's campaign was supposedly top-notch experts, and they missed obvious things they could have done to drive more people to the polls. The big late one lately, the biggest one, is the wrong envelope was handed out at the Oscars, and they actually brought up everybody from the wrong movie in the biggest night of the biggest moment of this huge night. And senior editor of Commentary, Abe Greenwald, makes an interesting point about expertise in our day.
But it strikes me that there's a tremendous paradox at work here, because while we're finding this sort of gross incompetence everywhere at high levels, it seems to me at the same time this culture of credentials has risen up over the past decades.
So what he's talking about there is this sense nowadays that you have to have a master's or a PhD, and college degree isn't even good enough anymore. You have to be an expert. You have to have the credentials. You have to have the right certification. The government has to recognize you as an expert in X or Y before your opinion really counts. And this has happened to me, Frank, to go back to local stuff. Some of the people now going after me have tried to do this. Oh, well, what do you know? Are you an accountant? What do you know about budgeting? Well, you know, it makes you wonder if having to be an accountant were a credential you needed, then maybe we shouldn't have elected officials, right? We should just let the experts and the credentialists, the well-credentialed class, run everything. But to Greenwald's point that there seems to be this paradox between our emphasis on credentials and experts getting a lot of things wrong, their online editor, Noah Rothman, responds this way.
Well, that doesn't seem incompatible to me at all. I mean, as these credentials, as credentialism has become paramount and credentials have increased in ubiquity, that their value has decreased.
Right.
And well, they're no longer trusted.
Well,
I would say that's just about exactly right. Although the fact that the credentials aren't trusted, that's a symptom. That's not the cause. It's not that there's so many that the value's gone down. It's that the value of the credential has superseded the value of the skill it's supposed to prove. So having that master's or that accounting credit degree or that license from the state, that's become the important thing, the piece of paper, not whether you actually absorbed the material beyond what you needed in order to pass whatever test there might have been. And fundamentally, getting a credential is a different skill than being able to do the thing. So testing is a different skill than balancing some books, right? Ultimately, in something like accounting might be a bad example because, you know, obviously it comes down to numbers and you can test people on whether they can do that. But in general, it's a different thing. It's just like being able to get money for a project is a different skill than being able to do the project. And we may all know people who've been able to make good livings at things that other people were better qualified to do. To bring in a pop culture kind of reference, although I don't know if he counts anymore. I read once about Jimmy Buffett ran into another, you know, hotel musician circuit guitar player, and he said, "You know, you're much better on that thing than I am, but you don't have the business sense, and that's why I'm going to be the star and you're not," something to that effect. It was Jimmy Buffett. Maybe he wasn't as nice back in those days or affable. But, you know, he had a point. Now, of course, the other side of the coin is that the uncredentialed, the unconnected, those who aren't, don't cross those thresholds, can have an effect and can really become experts, especially these days where everything is available online or what have you. And this seems not really related, but the editors in this commentary podcast went on to make a very, very interesting point about how a lot of our social institutions are no longer protecting themselves. So, for example, John Podhoretz, who's the main editor of commentary, who is heavily involved in drama and acting and stuff, pays a lot of attention to it, talked about how there's to this day question and controversy and conspiracy theorizing that My Cousin Vinny, the award, mistakenly won. Marissa Tomei, it took me a minute to get the name in my head. Sorry, teenage crushes. It's hard to keep track of. But she never really won the Best Actress award for My Cousin Vinny, but rather actor Jack Palance mistakenly, or for whatever reason, read her name off the bottom of the list of candidates, or just repeated it, and that's why she won. And the conspiracy is that rather than admit that, the Academy just said, you know what, we're gonna let it go, and we won't risk people losing faith in our whole process in which we pretend there's this big tallying of votes, and it's all very scientific and important and secure. So whereas the experts and the institutions used to stifle evidence of error, now maybe they can't. I mean, I wonder to some degree whether it's the internet. Maybe it's too easy to get caught. Once upon a time, a discreet sweep of the broom by an expert, in reality wasn't what it had actually been a moment ago. I think there's used to be a cliche of how if somebody said or printed something terrible in the paper, you could almost literally go out and get them all in a city and make that thing have not happened, or make that news not get out and change what people perceive as history. So I think also of things like all our controversies and all our examples of the experts getting things wrong in Rhode Island, you know, UHIP, the DMV computer system, the cooler and warmer, HealthSource Rhode Island too. So at the same time that the meritocracy, all the people who are supposed to be experts, they're falling to credentialism. They're hollowing out because everybody, you have to know somebody or have the right degree rather than be able to have proven that you were able to do the thing you're saying you're going to do. So at the same time as that, now people can also research independently and they can become uncredentialed experts. And at the same time as that, everything can be recorded very easily with a camera, with audio recorders, video recorders. There's some way something can end up captured in the moment and then made permanent on the internet, put out there. Everybody can see it. It gets captured, screenshot, archived. Now, at the same time as all of this, the experts think they can use government and central planning to just tell us how to live and make us all feel all better in that way. And so while Professor Nichols acknowledges sort of the boundaries of expertise, the real problem, the endemic problem, is that the experts don't seem to understand their own limits, even if they kind of know theoretically they exist. What is not good, they don't understand what's not good for them to try to plan and manage. They don't know where their real boundaries are. Now, this relates in my mind to an interesting essay by Roger Kimball on PJ Media. PJ, by the way, if you don't know, it stands for pajama, because back in the early days of blogging, all the non-experts became journalists and analysts, and the epithet was that we were all sitting around in our pajamas. Pajamas, if you prefer that way, opining as non-experts. It was a dismissive claim, and now it's been seized upon as a mantle and an emblem. So PJ Media, Roger Kimball. Now, Roger Kimball runs the New Criterion magazine, and he's very, very, let's say, upper crust kind of figure, striped suits, bow ties. I've seen him speak, and he talks about going boating with William F. Buckley and et cetera, et cetera. But he's at this party in Manhattan, I believe, with you know, the high-end journalist types. And this is an anecdote. It's kind of long, but I think it's important to read the whole thing. So this is Kimball. He says, "I ran into an acquaintance, a female journalist I hadn't seen in years. I knew that her politics were act conventional in the above sense, but I had also found her an amusing and lively person. We were chatting with a couple of other people about this and that, when someone she knew from the Times joined in. I then overheard him explain to her that she had to be careful about what she posted on Facebook, Twitter, etc., because anything too explicitly anti-Trump could be used against her when that glorious day came and they, in quotations, the conventional fraternity of groupthink scribblers, finally took down that horrible, despicable man." Quote, this is this Times journalist talking. "We've got dozens of people working on it all the time," he explained, adding that it was only a matter of time before they got the goods on Trump and destroyed him. This reads to me like if you've ever read any old Russian novels from the Romantic period, 1800s and so, it reads just like the party scenes from the set in the period before the fall of the Tsar. All this scheming of elites, nobles, lords and ladies, all this scheming founded in a, it's all founded in a distorted view of the world and kind of blind to what's about to happen. The feel is just like this reporter from the Times. And also I watched this week on Netflix a foreign movie, subtitles and stuff, you know, no non-elitist am I sometimes, but it's a movie called Sarajevo about the investigation of the assassination of Emperor-to-be Ferdinand, which is essentially what kicked off World War I and everything that followed. So, you know, honestly, I don't know the details enough to know how much this was kind of speculative, kind of like JFK the movie kind of playing up the conspiracy theory, or how much of it actually is documented truth. I don't know. But in essence, it comes to pass that the Germans and Austrians had kind of duped some dumb Slav kids into the assassination plot and set it up as a pretense for war. And so it was the Germans and the Austrians all scheming to start war so they could take over Europe. And it set into, from history I know, they set into play all this problem because everybody had alliances and agreements with everybody else, and it just became like dominoes falling apart and actually exploding. But we know from history how all that scheming kind of turned out, not only for the war and those participating in it, but for Germany as a country right after the war, for another war, and the whole rest of the century. And these elites were just sitting there scheming. And, they, you know, of course, at the time, they had all these theories about why they could do what they were planning. I mean, they were overt at that point. They were eugenicists. They thought, we're the superior race, and so we have to do this. We can do this. There was no hesitance about doing it. Nowadays, you know, out of shame, I guess, this might be a positive legacy of that time, if there can be such a thing. But out of shame, our elites these days won't really quite go there. Instead, they phrase everything in the negative. So in this movie, Sarajevo, this German doctor who you start to wonder at the end if he's really a doctor or just some kind of spy or something pretending to be a doctor. But he's being condescending to this Jewish investigator who's supposed to officially sign the document that condemns the assassins. And the investigator wants to write another report about how it was actually a conspiracy. That report we were led to understand is never made much of in the plot after the movie. So this German doctor is really condescending to the Jewish investigator, and he says pretty outright, you know, it's genetic, you know, you're inferior. But you know, what strikes you probably in the script and all certainly in the acting, that there wasn't really even a viciousness. The guy says, "I like you, honestly, I do, but you know, you're Jewish." He just thought it was cold, hard truth. Now, when you flip that, You don't get the experts sweeping away those who they honestly feel are not fortunate enough to be of their ilk, but you get like this viciousness, like I see locally, this viciousness of a crowd that has to make a villain of you in your own community. It's not that now the difference is in that run up to World War I, their thought was they were so good, they were so spectacular, and they just needed to break a few eggs, as the communist cliche goes, in order to bring about a better world. Now, they're shamed out of believing that themselves, but it's that you're so bad. You have to be overcome. You're the villain. And honestly, as a theoretical, objective matter, I'm not sure which of those is worse. Obviously, we know the history of eugenicism and hell, the World War I and World War II fell into horrible genocide. I guess we can only hope that the corresponding people, the progressives in modern times, who aren't there yet, never gain the power for that, or can be made to come to their senses and stop vilifying people as an excuse not to engage with them and accept the possibility that maybe those other people have a point, whether or not they're experts. So anyway, that's it for this week. As always, the links for all of the content I've mentioned here are on the post for this podcast, and I'd love also for you to leave commentary or send emails or what have you. I can tell from statistics people are listening, but I always want feedback, and it doesn't have to be whisper campaigns and insults on private Facebook pages. You can come out right out and say things, and we can have a debate. It's actually happened a few times this week because people have wanted to actually ask me about things. That's kind of how this all has to work. Anyway, have a great week. I'll see you next time around.
Run by your hand to the edge of our dreams. One foot in paradise. Thank you.